Okay, this is talking with Sir Herman Bondi at Churchill College in Cambridge on 14th March 1988. Now, could you first tell me just the kinds of things that you worked on during radar during World War II, and also when you first became aware of radio astronomy, what your impressions were of it?
Well, first talking about the work Hoyle and Gould and I did during the war. Hoyle, of course, had started in this business rather before me. I started in spring 42, Gould only in late 42. For almost all the time, from the summer of 42 on, in the Naval Radar Research Establishment, there was a theory division, the head of which was Fred Hoyle. I was his deputy.
I see.
And various other people belonged to it. I often boast about this unit, that no more than 7 people can claim to have belonged to it, 5 of whom subsequently became fellows of the Royal Society. So the brain power available was not negligible. We worked on a great variety of matters, of course, aerials, performance problems, noise problems, recognition problems, anything and everything on which theoretical work could throw any light. Mm-hmm. I would say that the first very strong impression that came across to me and has stayed with me ever since is how important it is for people with background in one particular field then to work in a different field. We had mathematicians like ourselves, physiologists, engineers of various kinds, and we all worked together, and by and large, in a novel field, coming from outside, in spite of a learning period, had positive advantages. Mm-hmm. It was clear to all of us that this expertise that had been gained in microwaves and the like, centimetric waves in general, during the war, could and would have substantial applications outside.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole attitude, when we heard of radio astronomy getting going, was totally positive.
Can you remember what you first hear of Hayes' report of 1942?
Yes, we did hear during the war. I don't think I knew it by name, but I knew that there was work on this.
That it had happened.
I knew that there was a great deal going on about external noise.
And limiting the receiver's performance.
Quite.
This kind of thing.
How the sun had an effect on this.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the idea that people who were essentially trained as physicists went into the astronomical field had my wholehearted mm-hmm. approval, applause, and support. Of course, different people are different from each other. Frank Graham Smith was the easiest of persons who really got going on the difficult question of how to link radio astronomy with the classical astronomical coordinate systems and thus to optical astronomy.
Right. Now you're skipping now till 1950 or 51.
Even the late 40s,
yes, right.
If you like.
Right.
And the very important problem in those days was that the radio systems, radio astronomy systems of the day were very inaccurate as far as direction was concerned, particularly,
right.
of course, at the longer wavelengths. And any and every attempt to improve this, again, had one's wholehearted approval.
Now, were you going to RAS meetings and following
these
years?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I would say that at that time already, clearly I'm speaking now from memory, I was much impressed when I first heard of Lovell's endeavor to get a really big dish.
Right.
Interferometric methods seemed to me to be certain to have a great future, but from various experience during wartime, I was already a little suspicious about the difficulties of interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
That there is a vast amount of material in interferometric observations, but getting the true information out of it can be difficult and have pitfalls.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to stress that, of course, computery was in its infancy.
Oh, yes.
In those days.
Well, they weren't using computers at all, as, for instance, for the 2C survey. They were just looking at the strip chart recordings.
Quite.
So are you saying that, in essence, that you felt that a single paraboloid was a more straightforward approach?
It was far easier to interpret the results from it, though even those have their difficulties. But one did not feel it was quite as
mm-hmm.
tricky
mm-hmm.
and did not have quite the problems that one had with interferometric measurements. Again, Martin Ryle, of course, was not quite as easy a person as Graham Smith, and particularly had strong disagreements in public, both with Hoyle and with Gould.
Right.
I don't think I ever clashed with him. I think we always were in good relations, but I did sympathize with my friends
mm-hmm.
because Ryle was very assertive. And retrospect, of course, nobody unassertive could ever have achieved a fraction of what he achieved. But it did lead to considerable friction. And there was particular, throughout astronomy, by no means through radio astronomy alone, a tension between the theoretical and the observational people.
What do you mean by attention?
Mutual suspicion.
Now, could you give another example of what you're referring to?
Oh, I mean, in ordinary astronomy, of course, one of the great conflicts following Hoyle and Lyttelton.
Hoyle and Lyttelton, 1939?
Thereabouts.
Yes.
We all fully accepted that it was unsound to assume that the only significant and important objects were stars,
mm-hmm.
and that interstellar matter, or possibly intergalactic matter, could play a major role.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying we got it right, but the attitude of many optical astronomers in those days reminded me of somebody who flies over a country at night and say a country that is a collection of streetlights.
Yes, right. So what you're saying is that the kinds of theories that you and Hoyle and Gould like to put out brought you into conflict not just with radio astronomers, but in fact with many aspects of the astronomy community.
Quite. I mean, some were sort of simple philosophical points. I mean, we were all basically Popperians, our group. That is to say, one puts up a theory and then has it tested by experiment and observation. One does not try to extrapolate into a theory from observations
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and does not infer from the fact that one only sees stars that there's nothing else about.
Right.
And so there was a good deal of disagreement. In one of more cantankerous moments, I published a paper, it was published in Vistas in Astronomy, I remember, Fact and Inference and Theory and Observation. Because you see the observers, not just radio astronomy,
right.
all those days, always felt
mm-hmm.
that they were handling facts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we were just spinning ideas.
Right. Now, roughly when is that published?
In the mid-50s, I should think.
I'll have to check that, yes.
Vistas in Astronomy.
Right.
It may be that I have a copy here, but I'm not at all sure that I do.
Now, Hoyle and Gold, it seems to me, came into conflict in the late 40s.
Can I go back a little to tell you a little funny story?
Yes, go ahead. I'll come back.
Of course, some people on both sides of the camp watched this conflict with amusement and sometimes with very great insight. Struve, the American astronomer,
yes,
once put it very well, I thought, when he compared the observers with their massive equipment to people sailing through space on battleships, to theoreticians sitting in their armchairs and blowing bubbles from the imagination. And he says every now and then a bubble collides with a battleship, and everybody's surprised when the battleship gets sunk.
That's nice. I never heard that one yet.
Struve was a delightful character.
Yeah.
And of course, we were not always right, by no means. I mean, it's not necessary or even desirable in science always to be right. But as you were saying, there wasn't just that conflict.
So it seems like you took upon yourself the role of provocateurs almost.
Yes, very much so.
What I was going to say is that in the late 40s, Fred Hoyle already had come into conflict with Martin Ryle, not on one of these philosophical things so much as on the details of the mechanism for the radio bursts in the sun.
Yes, yes.
Do you recall this?
I don't, just as a witness?
No. Because I was wondering if this was the first time that they came into conflict. It was nothing to do with cosmology. It was just some things to do with radio bursts.
And one of the great conflicts at the meeting in London was, again, I think I couldn't give you, around 1950, between Ryle and Gold.
Yes, that's 51. Yes, I know that meeting.
When the radio astronomers called their sources always radio stars, and Gold first suggested they might be galaxies, and Ryle rounded on them furiously, "We know they are stars, so why do you say this?"
Right, yes.
Which is quite amusing in the light, but happened only 3 or 4 years later.
That's right. And of course, he did a complete change around.
Yes.
Let's go to the steady state theory specifically. Now, of course, when you formulated it after the war, radio astronomy was not paying any part in that formulation.
No,
I think that's
not at
correct,
all.
Of course. I think it was primarily the time scale difficulty.
Right.
And so forth. And so.
And some of the philosophical difficulties.
Right. And now, how did you hope that at that time that observations might bear on this theory?
Well, let us put it both positively and negatively. My challenge to all those who didn't like the steady state theory in those days was always, look, if the universe ever was in a very different state from today, then there should be some fossil remains of those days.
Mm-hmm.
Show me a fossil.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the fossil that was paraded then was the group of elements heavier than helium, which, and you come back to Gamow and Lemaître. But that was beginning to feel, we felt very widely, but the nuclear physicists didn't work. And of course, I regard it as the prime achievement of steady state, that it provoked the nuclear genesis work by Hoyle, the Burbages, and Fowler.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an outstanding achievement. And that certainly demonstrated, I think, to everybody's satisfaction, that the heavy elements were not a fossil for a different state of the universe. There was also, a few years earlier, a little noticed, rarely quoted paper by Salpeter, which showed, in fact, that if elements had been created in the Big Bang, they would all have again returned to helium and hydrogen in the expansion.
I see.
So that not only was the Big Bang factory unnecessary, it wouldn't even have worked.
And now, is that generally accepted, or was that just...
I think it was widely accepted, yes.
I see. I'm not familiar with that.
A very competent man. Where I strongly suspected the greatest danger to steady state would come from is from the helium abundance in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And I particularly, I already then had the suspicion there was more helium around, though the amount was ill-known.
More than what?
More than steady state could stomach, because in steady state, of course, all the helium would have been produced in ordinary stars by the thermonuclear reactions, and therefore there should be a relation between the amount of helium and the amount of light.
And did one feel in the early 50s confident enough in the standard beta reactions to feel
well,
it should be this much?
It doesn't matter much what the reaction is, because after you know the energy difference between helium and hydrogen,
yes.
True, you didn't know quite what percentage was going to be carried away by the neutrinos, but it certainly wasn't 3/4 of it.
Right, I see what you're saying, yeah. So given the luminosity that you saw, you could...
You could. And the greatest expert on sort of element identification in those days was Andrew McKellar.
Yes, that's right.
And I remember several conversations with him on this topic where I stressed to him the importance of defining, of finding out how much helium there was, stressing also it wasn't a percentage in relation to hydrogen was important, it was the total amount that was important.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the fossil I was looking for most.
What about galaxy counts? How did you view those?
I viewed those with the utmost suspicion. You see, I know this is one of those curious sidelights to history, but I've often told the story how it was when I saw that steady state agreed with Hubble's number counts, that I was first driven to the publication of it. And then, when, of course, not much later, Hubble's distance scale was totally overthrown by Vade.
Right, 52.
In 52. Of course, the identity with the number counts went out of the window.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if number counts could mislead me that much, I didn't think they would be very good
so
for anybody
you've been
else.
Burnt by them. In
I've
like,
been
yeah,
burnt.
Yeah, yeah.
More than that, you know that I've been very much intrigued by Olver's paradox.
Yes.
And you notice from almost everything I've said and done, looking far away seems to me in some ways the least effective way of studying cosmology. Its
yeah.
influence is here. Background light, inertia, helium quantities, yes. And the background radiation, the 3 degrees, certainly it's right
that's
up my
right
street.
Yes.
That's a fossil I did not foresee.
Right.
And that's come
right.
home to roost.
Right.
But it's of the kind of test
yes.
of cosmology that I regard as fully justified.
Yes.
And very sensible. To extrapolate to the furthest, and of course, with a 100-inch...
And pushing instruments to their very limit always. And
you always get into trouble. So I wasn't at all inclined pro-number counts.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it was intriguing that one could make number counts in the radio wavelengths. But naturally, at the time when you couldn't identify them, the absence of a redshift, of course, raised one's suspicions very strongly.
Now, of course, Ryle felt confident by 1955, he felt confident they were all extragalactic because he argued about the contribution to the galactic background.
Quite.
And
the
integrated...
The I mean, he had...
But you didn't like that argument? There were indeed, of course, only 5 or 10 that were identified, and half of those were in the galaxy and the
yes.
other half were outside.
Yeah, I know, quite. The number seemed to be small. I saw the argument. I saw the weight of that. But at the same time, of course, there were Bernie Mills measurements, which didn't agree at all.
But now we have to be careful. Those came along 2 years later. Ryle's Halley lecture and so forth was 1955, and it wasn't until 2 years later, at least the publication, maybe a year later for the preprint.
No, it was already known. I do remember that on the occasion when the RAS had its meeting at Manchester.
That's 55,
that
yeah.
was 55. And we went to look at Jodrell Bank.
Yeah.
There were already, to put it mildly, strong rumors
I see.
That Mills' measurements were not at all in agreement with 2C.
I see. So I'll have to check into that.
That is
Pausi was at that meeting, and probably he was the one that was bringing that news.
That is very clear in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Jeffrey Burbage saying to me, "But with those measurements, you just sit down and lick your chops."
So you didn't have the details then, but you just had news that there were differing measurements, and that was enough for you to say, "All right, let's just wait and see what happens."
All right.
But now, was the announcement at the Halley Lecture and so forth, was that a complete surprise, or did you know this kind of thing was going on?
I knew there was work going on. I knew there was work.
And did you know it was leading this kind of conclusion, or was that all out of the blue?
I don't think anything came out of the blue. One of the things that thoroughly surprised me was the belief that it was quite as steep. That instead of a three-half law, it was a cube law.
Right.
And that aroused my suspicions. Because while I could see that the real world might not be the steady-state world, I found it difficult to believe that it could be that wildly different by factor two.
Yes.
And that strengthened my skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
But I should say at the same time, that, of course, that was the period when I effectively left cosmology. I don't think I published anything in the field after the early 50s, except for the second
edition of your book,
forward in
1960. Right.
And that was a rather minor revision. And that really was my last involvement with the subject.
So you did not get involved in looking into the details of the how the 2C survey was done and what instrumental problems there might be. That was much more what Hoyle did, of course.
Quite. No, it wasn't my business at all.
Right. Nor did you get involved in the idea of revising the steady state.
That I've always been totally hostile to. You see, the beauty of the steady state always seemed to me its rigidity, its Popperian vulnerability.
Right.
And I was not going to take any hand in defacing it by...
Right. Let me just say that this adjective Popperian is referring to Karl Popper's idea of falsifiability, just
quite
right. Let me ask about the Gamow's theory, which you mentioned briefly. But, of course, in retrospect, we can look back and see that there is this prediction sort of buried a little bit, but it's there of a background of a universe at a small temperature. This, of course, was not appreciated during the 50s, and then it seems like its discovery in the early 60s is, in fact, what finally ended all of this argument. Would you agree with that? And what, or were you aware of this idea of a background at all, or was anyone aware? Can you help me with that?
It's a very good question you ask, but I don't feel very competent giving the answer. My own impression is that Lemaître and Gamow were aware that there might be a background radiation, but did not regard this as an important test, because they didn't see how observable it should be.
Mm-hmm.
You must remember, of course, that in those days also, the understanding of the reaction between radiation and matter was not as good as it became later.
Mm-hmm.
So when the uncoupling would occur was still a very vague matter.
Right.
Ability to measure in the far infrared, in the microwave region, was virtually non-existent. And so this was not considered, according to my recollection, as something very important. And when it happened, as I was saying, it came as a surprise to me.
Mm-hmm.
But then I'd been out of the subject, of course, for 10 years or more.
But certainly Gamow was not going around and trying to encourage people with microwave receivers that this is a good test of my theory.
No, he was much more interested, of course, in the origin of the elements.
Right.
And, of course, he was absolutely right. I mean, the origin of the elements is a very important matter. And if cosmology can really contribute and comes into my picture, the evidence for cosmology is here. So You know, if I, that it's a little deviation, you know that 150 years ago the geologist Lyell said the present is the key to the past.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, the uniformitarian attitude.
Yes.
My attitude always, our knowledge of cosmology comes from here.
Here, right. Here and now.
As
far as
that
goes. That's right.
Yes.
Interesting.
Attitude. And so that it is, well, you see, there are so many strands that come together. The early work on stellar structure by Edington and others, and other work by Jeans, really still had an outlook that there was a good deal of heavy material in the sun.
Yes, that's right.
The idea that hydrogen was so predominant came in fairly slowly. If I rightly remember, the first person who did this was Bill McRae in one of his, some of his early work in the early 30s.
Well, there's a painter, Poshkin,
yes,
from the observational side.
That, I thought, came a little late.
No, that's her thesis in the mid-20s.
Yes, I see. I didn't know that. That's very good.
Now, how generally accepted that was,
no,
I don't know that.
Certainly by the mid-40s, late-40s, when I came into this, one still had to fight, rather, for saying hydrogen is the only important thing. So, Gamow was a brother under the skin, in a sense, because it's only those who were convinced of the dominance of hydrogen,
yes,
who could see that the existence of this tiny bit of spice of heavy elements
yes,
was a puzzle that cosmology had to solve.
Right, right.
I mean, many astronomers would not at that stage have regarded the origin of the heavy elements as a question.
That's interesting, yeah. Yeah.
And so Gamow recognized this very clearly. I think, you know, it's important that people make contributions of their nature should not be forgotten.
Yes, oh, I agree wholeheartedly. Going back to the discovery of the microwave background, the standard view that one hears, of course, is that this is what led to the final demise of steady state. The number counts were becoming more reliable. They still seem to be going against steady state, but it was really the microwave background that did it in. Do you agree with that? What comments would you have on
well, the microwave background and the helium abundance. Clear ideas on the helium abundance. These still seem to me stronger than number counts.
And did you see it at that time as being a very quick change?
You see, I was far too far out of things.
That's right, you had gotten.
I mean, scientifically I'd left cosmology, basically, when I moved to London in 54. By 67, I was in full-time administrative work.
Right. So it was just during the middle of that period that these things were happening.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much.
Well,
that ends the interview with Herman Bondi on 14 March 88, and this is the end of this tape.